Blog Talk Radio.
Good to have you here again. Thank you for tuning in, and again, Happy New Year! Happy New Year! It's a joyous New Year. I hope it's a year that respects you, helps to fulfill your dreams. Ah, there you have it. Eh? We face challenges as usual. Just to perhaps highlight it for us by media and tensions in our communities. Tensions that, you know, seem to be heightened, and so that the thought here is that we'll pay more attention because somebody else tells us it's serious rather than what we experience for ourselves. And nothing new there. It's 2021. The year begins with, as it always does, a sense of optimism, a sense of renewal and change. And I like to be drawn back to the celebrations of around Stonehenge because it has a sense of true antiquity that I enjoy. It's a connection. Funny bunch we are. Not funny, haha. Funny. We enjoy the effect of sentimentalism because that's what we're doing here. This is very, it's a show, a program designed to relax us and to help focus our attention and then an exchange of ideas, a connection through the airwaves. And it seems to be beneficial to a number of people. It's a treat. Something we can look forward to. But, you know, so as I'm reading through some of the history that we're going to get into later in the program, I noticed about the context of and what was happening. You know, we started off without secrets. We started off, as I like to suggest, leaning in conversation around tables, whether it's in a somebody's home or in a roadhouse, doesn't really matter. Because the conversation was more important than the location, and then these men began making tribal sounds. Wanting to identify them and us, it was you and I that trusted each other, as we do, and we're able to talk about things that that people would mock, but we thought it was serious. Like the idea behind, let's say we're talking about the idea behind capitalism or materialism, those types of isms. Well, who has time for that type of thing? If we did it and said, well, you know, how do we relate to this whole notion of exploitation and poverty? Well, you know, who's going to have that conversation? Well, maybe after I buy you a round or two or you buy me, we'll have that kind of conversation and it will be lively. And if we begin to trust each other, we will become polemicists. You know, we'll be able to disagree with each other and impress it. You know, that where it's just pure fun. You're just adding to the idea, piling it on and exploring it. And then after we dissect it and think there's parts of it that we reflect on, that reflect on us. I can't imagine going from that to being a visitor and being a traveler down the road and listening in, or having one at your table invite me over. And then the same thing recurring in other places, to the point where we began to think that some form of identification would be a good idea, to cut out the presence of the hypocrites and the cynics. You know, we don't need that at the table. It's easy enough to slide into that type of reasoning, or you know, the pious that have the answers to all, if you just have some form of adhesion to a particular ideology or belief. You know, how would you shorten that so we didn't have to go through as tedious, like, oh, you know, the end of the night, then we find out the guy is just, you know, he's wasting his time. And nobody's so impolite to say, you know, bugger off, you know, get buy us around and leave. You know, it's like, no. To think that all of a sudden, somewhere in that, the quality of the conversation became more important, became so important that we wanted to identify. And that's what I mean by a tribal. Only our tribal identity was pushed, because we were at the time thinking, I don't know if you'd say, what's the word, in ideals? But certainly when we asked this question of ourselves back in the day, we addressed it from a philosophical point of view, from a religious point of view, and then the polemists at the table got into it. Well, why is yours a purer form or an identifier? Why not that fellow over there? And does it really matter what his faith is? Do we really give a crap? At the end of the day, it was we made it sound a little more appropriate and said, well, it doesn't matter at all. Whatever it is, it is. But how did we weed out atheists in the crowd? Well, that's not the question of how, it's why. At any given moment, you know, the Archbishop would talk to me and we would be able to embrace those doubts, those questions, without throwing our hands in the air and running down the hall. Perhaps we all have that. Maybe that is the that notion of dualism that triggers us. You know, that there must be a heaven, because what's the world really like? How do we answer? Well, if there isn't, well, what's the question? What are you really getting at? So I could see why we'd like some identifiers after a while. Just like, you know, do you have a bit of character, a bit of intelligence about you? Have you done a bit of reading? It's not like you have to be an encyclopedia or a PhD. No. Are you a person that takes life seriously? Well, all right. So here we created this form of identification, and it became a bit more protracted, and each time it became a little more elaborate, that meant we had more to do, more to carry with us, more to carry forward, And then they had that exchange at the around the table. And by the way, it's always your round. whose round is it? That exchange became a bit more, what, diverse? Well, of course it would. It's easier to maintain that feeling of goodwill when your mates are the same, or you have keep that core group. Well, we didn't really overthink it. We over-engineered it in a way. But I think it was, in all fairness now, I think it was necessary. And because it created more facets, more mathematics to the process. So that I think the idea was that nobody would be left out because of the structure. Which brings me to the point. And thank you for asking, what is he going for today? Well, the point of it is, the structure is about being part of an organization, being part of something, let's not call it even an organization, being part of a wish or a thought of where self-regulation becomes more important than somebody with an authority. It defines the critical authority. Not, I don't know, ultimate. I'll say, who knows? The ultimate authority is what? Physics? But the critical authority rests within each one of us, if you're inclined in this direction. Oh, what do we do when we've allowed... we've changed our own boundaries, our own regulation in a way, and said, well, he's a good fellow, his pocket's full of coins, and he should sit at the table, and we'll listen to him. We'll just get so hammered that it won't matter what he says. We'll slap him on the back and say, come on back in a month, we'll do it again. Well, we've let that happen, and then where do you have that serious conversation? Well, when he leaves or staggers out, then you hunker down and have that conversation. What an ass. Or wasn't that interesting? Then maybe he reveals to us that he's a Mohammedan. In the day they would have used terms like that, or Jew, or Catholic. Remember, these were cutthroat days. There was a live excitation out there. The authority was being challenged. And if it couldn't be, it wasn't challenged where we were, in our countryside, we certainly would get messages from France telling us about the revolutionary spirit, the revolutionary fed up, the revolutionary tired of the deceit, the hypocrisy, revolutionaries prepared to redefine, because we're not much different today. No, we just lose track of that because we don't have this conversation. We don't have this laid out there for us. Self-regulation. This is, is it hard? It's hard for men that don't get it. No, they'll flop around, and I've mocked them talking about where my difficulty rests is when there's so many people with that club-like mentality that they've begun to think that's what masonry is. And remember, we allowed them to the table. We needed to, we were hoping, fingers crossed, that this person would also have some sense of legitimate spirituality about him. Not that Ponzi, here I am, and this is a symbol, this is the outward appearance, so afford me some status. Nope. Is he capable? Well, too many of those people incapable together can be quite influential, can't they? Influential to a point. And this is where Then we're going to get into some music here, and I'll be quiet for a while. They can't influence what you're really about or why you really came forward. Don't put the fault on masonry. No, don't put the fault at the feet of administrators. No. That's not masonry. I'm afraid. Sorry. You know. And you know it. For all the ego strokes we get, who do you want that accolade? And do you want people to stand up and applaud when you walk into the room? I have difficulty with that. And the false modesty that goes, I don't like that either. Not much. Nope. Men of conscience don't need all of that. The part of masonry that has been beyond authority or command and control has been you. We can sit down and tell you things. We can instruction. If you, here is you, we're going to tell you because we know you better than you know you. My goodness, if I do that, put me out of my misery. My hope through this type of program is to remind you, point out things not because they're earth-shattering, but because they're a reminder. During the day, during our busy work lives, over the course of the years, some of these notions can be obscure. And do you know when you walk past something that inspires you and you think, that's what I'm about? Well, we don't do that very much. And I don't blame it on the media. Little sound bites that bring that sense of anticipation. Every idea has to be contained and agree with my own idea, because there's an algorithm picking these ideas out for me. And it's time limited. Yeah, 180 seconds, period. Let's move on. But when you're relaxed and you're reflective, you're capable of far more attention than that. Here, I can't or wouldn't. It wouldn't matter if I was trying to intrude on that. Because underneath it, you'll feel that resistance. You'll feel that pushback. This doesn't feel right. But at the end of the day, I think it's legitimate to ask, are you pushing back on the idea or on your own struggle with it? There is a myth that I think a lot of men carry forward, and people carry forward. It's that they know their capability. My experience with people has taught me otherwise. I don't mean we're capable of far more stupidity than we normally exhibit. No. I'm not going to say that there was the divinity of humanity was when we were wild and untamed. No, I'm not that. We can create some beautiful things. We can laugh. And we can laugh with others. We can do terrible things, but we can do remarkable things. And we learn to correct so that the terrible things don't continue. Or they're isolated. And then we continue to thrive. So, masonic effects. Maybe you'll be kind and see it as a doorway or a window into that place where your sight is really clear, where it just feels good. Not because what we're saying and doing here lines up with your thinking, but because you're receptive, that you're influencing the conversation. Hey, let's sit back and enjoy with us. Good commentary today. And a little music to help focus us all. Larry McKenna.
Thank you.
That'll just have to do. Wherever you are. Oh, beautiful. Beautiful, and they get into a groove, don't they? It's difficult, I suspect, for a lot of people, even brethren. I'm going to difficult. And they chase conformity. I wrestle with this idea of materialism, and, you know, with wealth and power. It's, you know, we have those canards thrown out every so often, and the real power rests within your mind, what you're willing to tolerate, what you're willing to sacrifice, the truth of it all. It's not some oligarch or military authority. No, the real power always has been. That's why despots tend to want to kill the likes of us. You can't kill the idea. Even if they kill us, the idea continues on. Hmm? No. Conformity with the order or with anything else, how's that working for you? Is it, you finding, truthfully, are you finding validation in that? So that works, you know. So our ideas aren't don't have merit unless the room is nodding in agreement. Oh, we know when we're being silly, and we know when we're exploring and investigating. And we use influences. We have influences around us. The arts do that for us constantly, constantly. Here, joy is serious as life. It isn't for nothing that the story of our history has been passed along through the centuries. The pieces fall into place for fewer men than you might guess. It seems to happen when he comes in contact with the feeling he has, when he holds the thought of masonry in mind. The appeal is not what it answers, but what it asks. The value is not what is asked, but what answers we give and how we go about answering. So many metaphors, only a hint of self-discipline. The Gestalt reckons with our awareness. One does not find this what he hears, but what he perceives of life. Nietzsche tells us art is the fundamental metaphysical activity of man. It is less an assertion than a question. What is he talking about? Art, as according to ritual, we are able to study, or art, that is paint and paper. When we walk away from our ritual, many forget about the event. He was not in the room present. The words are about him, not of him. What questions are put to him are answered as if he does not have agency. Only when he asks the questions of himself does he begin to benefit from the answers he discovers. Moment by moment, first any answer, gradually the answer. Questions trigger ideas, or they are ignored. Poetry tells us this repeatedly. We walk through life with an ability to connect our spirit with our surroundings, or or distracted and disconnected. The questions reveal the precision of thinking, which is another way of saying they reveal whether we matter, whether we take ourselves seriously enough to ask questions that others mock. Oh. Until that day, that moment when life comes together with death, what say you then? Something about John Coltrane, eh? Just a sort of like a hook, you know, just sort of draws you in. Today I'm going to share a bit of poetry with you from an influencer. That's an interesting term that that's used around internet circles, influencers, social media circles. This fellow was. It's from that period of romanticism and the romantic poetry that was a reaction to earlier restriction, topic restriction. This is really where we began to see emotional response being shared and described, connection. So when you sat there and had an emotional awareness with some event, whether it's in your environment or something that happened or other people, you were able to write about it without being condemned and criticized. And remember, this was still these undercurrents. These currents didn't go away. They're still with us. Don't talk that way, you know, because it brings up notions and those wrongful ideas. Well, these were the wrongful ideas. This is where we see poetry, you know, in a different perspective, attempting to reveal and help connect us with truths through observation. I don't know how many of you may know about Keats and Coleridge and Byron. You may have heard those terms before, but how many of you have also heard about Robert Southey? An interesting guy, and I don't know if we care that he was, you know, that his father was bankrupt at one time, except, you know, it makes the point that this isn't about Silver Spoon. Poetry isn't Silver Spoon. It's about a more essential part of life. And he was friends, you know, he was an educated fellow, and he's friends with other writers and people that had things in common. The same as you and I, we befriend people that we have something, that share things in common. But he felt, you know, over the course of his history and the analysis it's gone on, he went into poetry and criticism and history, and he was a writer. Wasn't like I think that he was saying, well, I'm going to write something about journalism or do a biography. It was like he wrote, and then when we look at him and say, well, that afterward, that's poetry, that's history, that's biography. He shared, and he was influential. People paid attention to him. Oxford Reference gives it like this. So he had a strange career, moving from extreme radicalism in the 1790s to a gloomy conservatism in the 1810s. He was born in Bristol, and he was educated in Blois College in Oxford, and that's where he met Coleridge. And they planned a liberated American settlement, Penticocracy. It was sort of that utopian. It would be a utopian community on the banks of the Susquehanna. Yeah, and in 1794, he joined with Coleridge in a drama, The Fall of Robespierre. He went from the radical, you know, you think about the period, this is when the French Revolution was just hitting that, the tinder was just being sparked. Eh? What was that? 1780s, 1790s, Jim. And other country, other nations were aware if it could happen there, where the monarch was divine, it could happen anywhere. It's a sentiment that's still, it's a property, not a sentiment, it's a property that's still with us today. So judge for yourself here how much truth. I selected this because it just, at the time, it just felt interesting. It's about a hermit named Henry. Mm. And see what you think about what he says. It's what it says about his observation, our observations, our ability to connect. You know, does the sun turn our head? It was as he begins, it was a little island where he dwelt, or rather a lone rock, barren and bleak, short, scanty herbage, spotting with dark spots. Its gray stone surface. Never mariner approached that rude and uninviting coast, nor ever fisherman his lonely bark anchored beside its shore. It was a place befitting well a rigid anchoret, dead to the hopes and vanities and joys and purposes of life. And he had dwelt many long years upon that lonely island, for in ripe manhood he abandoned arms and honors and friends and country and the world, and had grown old in solitude. That isle, some solitary man in other times had made his dwelling place, and Henry found the little chapel that his toil had built. Now by the storms unroofed, his bed of leaves, wind scattered, and his grave were grown with grass and thistles. Those white seeds, winged in vain, withered on rocks and in the waves were lost. So he repaired the chapel's ruined roof, and he cleared the gray lichens from the altar stone. Underneath a rock that sheltered him from the sea blast, he built his hermitage. The peasants from the shore would bring him food and beg his prayers, but human converse else he knew not in that utter solitude, nor ever visited the haunts of men, save when some sinful wretch on a sick bed, imploring his blessing and his aid in health, death. That summons he delayed not to obey, though the night tempest or autumnal wind maddened the waves, and though the mariner, albeit relying on his saintly load, grew pale to see the peril. So he lived a most austere and self-denying man, till abstinence and age and watchfulness exhausted him, and it was pain at last to rise at midnight from his bed of leaves and bend his knees in prayer. Not yet the less, though with reluctance of infirmity, he rose at midnight from his bed of leaves and bent his knees in prayer, but with more zeal, more self-condemning fervor raised his voice. For pardon for that sin, till that the sin repented was a joy like a good deed. And one night upon the shore his chapel bell was heard, and the air was calm, and its far sounds over the water came distinct and loud. Alarmed at this unusual hour to hear its toll irregular, a monk rose. The boatman bore him willingly across, for well the hermit Henry was beloved. He hastened to the chapel, and on a stone Henry was sitting there, cold and stiff and dead, the bell rope in his hand, and at his feet, the lamp that streamed a long, unsteady light.
Every kiss, there's a melody.
Whenever I listen to Sarah Vaughan, I have this experience that she's singing only to me and the rest of you don't exist. I don't understand it myself. Maybe you've felt that way about a performance or music. But I think, do you think the signs and tokens that we use are acts of conformity? I know. I suppose somebody might suggest that, you know, looking from the outside. But internally, I think they're an acknowledgement, a way for us to acknowledge, and perhaps acknowledge a devotion. I don't mean the clamor about and the competition. Not that. That's from the I like to think that is the influence of the profane world. No, I'm thinking about the acknowledgement. I'm a Mason, so I conduct myself in a certain way. And here are the fundamentals that have been passed on from that early table where we sat and decided that, you know, we'll cut through the chase scene. We don't need the pious crap and the nonsense and the egoists coming wanting us to build them up because they need it. Or people that are only paying attention to us because they think they can get something from us. You know, these are still common traits, common considerations. Our short version was here's a sign that is an acknowledgement that he's not like that. He's not tedious. He's not going to waste your time. If only, I think, silly to think that we don't understand that. So we cheapen it. We give away a lot of this. Well, you don't need to do that. You don't need to, certainly you don't need to understand what those are about. You just sit down. And by the way, do you have a checkbook? hardly seems appropriate. 1734, we're here to be reinforced by a connection with our history, whatever connection you make with it. A transformation was ensuing. The power to govern decisively. Remember, we're talking about that records from early masonry, the extant records. The power to govern decisively was placed in the hands of the gentlemen Freemasons. I don't know if that's exactly the end of the influence of the operatives, but 1734, the occasion for this shift of authority over the government of the lodge involved both money and labor. Money had been inappropriately lent without proper security. Craftsmen not belonging to the guild had been employed, while the quality of craftsmanship of some operative members was deemed inadequate. At the annual meeting of 1734, the gentlemen of substance were elected as the officers. The Honorable John, Master of Gray, was chosen as Master of the Lodge, and he was also a local agricultural improver. Suddenly, language employed by London Freemasons and first displayed in Anderson's 1723 constitutions is used in full force. Terms appear that are not to be found in the records of the Dundee operative Masons. The Society of Free and Accepted Masons, and the Honorable Society of the Ancient Lodge. Laws and regulations for the better and orderly government of the respective brethren. Brothers are charged with the task of assembling to consider of such laws and regulations as shall seem proper and requisite for the better government of the society, with full power to make them and enact in the locked book of the society such laws as shall seem best for preserving order and unanimity among the brethren, and punishing delinquents of whatever rank or degree. A committee was established to do just that. And for the first time in these 70 or more years of records, reference is made to the secret mysteries of masonry. It shall no longer be lawful by any or number of the brethren of the lodge in this place to initiate or enter any person or persons of whatever degree of quality as they may have access to the knowledge of the ancient and secret mysteries of masonry without first apprising the worshipful, the master of the lodge, with whose consent and approbation a man may be admitted. In this context, the secrets refer to the traditional skills of craftsmen as well as to signs and words used to properly initiated guild masons signal to one another their status and enhance their right to work in the vicinity. It is significant that only now does emphasis on the secrets of Freemasonry appear. Signs and tokens of membership were the everyday manner of communication among guild craftsmen. They have now become symbolic of devotion to the fraternity, loyalty, and probity. The ability to keep the secrets of masonry rather than the practice of those mysteries became the only means of identifying a true brother. This social cement was mystical only insofar as it was language memorized out of the original context. It now became words and signs used in the bonding of men who were different from one another in nearly every aspect of their lives, save their membership in a constitutionally governed private society. Eventually, the secrets of masonry will acquire a metaphoric meaning as brothers rise by degree toward a veiled yet constantly unfolding wisdom and enlightenment. Accompanying this process will be ever more elaborate ceremonies conferring status and honor within the lodge. Our history simply explains. We became a bit more complicated out of necessity. Times changed, and we had to adapt. Let's not lose track of that. Acting like it takes a certain type of whatever to think that the problem that we have is about change. That's just ego. That's just like making up stories. You know, the difficulty we have, we create. It's not something external. We create it. It's as if we can't have purpose without some kind of conflict going on, some kind of tension. Is that all about maleness? Really? Internal, external? I don't know. Here's a little Duke Jordan from the 1973 album that you did in Denmark. It's cool. Thank you. As the years went on, our responsibilities grew. We became more institutional, certainly more institutional. And we adapted, we changed, we became ready to organize, and we were asking questions and we answered them. And the answers are what we reflect on today. Oh, think about it. When I was with medical students, I realized, back in the early period of medicine, what they had to learn was much different than what they learn today. The same with law, any of the professions, any of the trades. We've progressed, and so we require our apprentices to know more. And it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? My dear old dad, the old farmer, was able to discuss metallurgy with engineers. At the end of his time in the trade, you learn more because we had access to more. Masonry seems to be a bit of a paradox. And I think it's not to do with masonry. I think it's to do with our own self-consciousness, our own sense of trying to moderate the influences, to pull them back. And maybe this was done under external pressure, because by itself, masonry is enormously influential and powerful. You make your own, you understand your own purpose and you make your own decisions. That means you're no longer a political cat. You're your own man, your own intellect. It doesn't have gender. There is something that triggered us to do what we do. But inside you is still that, I believe, is still that sense. I don't know if I would call it magic, that purposefulness of masonry, the validation, certainly, that that devotion matters, that history matters, that life is complicated and serious, and that it's not all easy. It's not all about winning. It's about understanding and knowing. And it's not about convincing yourself of that. It's like accepting that that's a fact. That's a fact. Anyway, this first program of 2021 is drawn to an end, sadly for me. I hope that you've enjoyed it, and I look forward to having you sit in with us again in a week, the great architect willing, and that this year brings prosperity and calmness to your life. I only do this song maybe once or twice a year. It's just because I love her voice. It's my indulgence. Thank you for being with us. Hope it's been informative and interesting.
Coucou, Naked Noise, c'est Zaz, et on va vous faire Je veux, avec Ilan à la basse, et bien me gérer à la guitare. En santé, tout le monde.
Yes.
Awa, tu... One, two, three, four!
I'm
Thank you.